Welcome to Grow Sessions. This is Tony Pavlakis. I'm here today with my good friend Jason Hadley from Filter. Hey, Jason, how are you today?
Fantastic. Can't awesome, wait to be man. Here. I'm loving it.
This is good stuff. Yeah, so Jason and I have met a couple years ago. We always chat about just being like in facilities, the cleanliness of facilities and cannabis microcontrol and cultural practices. But I wanted to have Jason on the show, and he's going to tell us a little bit about what his company does and what he does a little bit and how, like, you know, just making good air, you know, making good air better and, you know, bad air good type things. But Jason, give a quick intro of like who you are, where you're from, what you guys do, and then we can just kind of chat about some of the stuff that we talk about.
Absolutely. So my name is Jason Hadley. I'm with Filter. Filter is owned by Lighthouse Worldwide Solutions, which is a 40-year-long supplier of clean room monitoring equipment and tools for pharmaceutical, medical device, you know, any of those like bunny suit level semiconductor facilities, that type of stuff. And
sure,
they saw the writing on the wall. They've been answering to the FDA, the EPA, OSHA for like 40 years now. They saw cannabis as an emerging regulatory market. And at the, you know, they're like, listen, we have all of this knowledge. It turned out there are some people internal to Lighthouse that might have some growing experience. And so they saw this bridge around like this industry going into like a newly regulated direction, but maybe not having all of the fundamental tools, processes, and practices that are already common in environments where you want to keep out contaminants.
Okay.
So, you know, in part and parcel, like you see the filter unit behind me here, this is a HEPA air purifier. HEPA is a standard technology in clean room design. They don't use UV. They don't use off-gassing hydrogen peroxide devices, PCO, stuff like that. So there's a standard in place that's already exists. And it's just a matter of getting cultivators pointed in that direction, because you'd be surprised. I mean, it's shocking how much that clean room practices and cannabis facilities share commonly between like their cleanliness needs. You know, when it comes to like, so cannabis cares about mold spores primarily, right? Because that's what stops the product from getting onto a retail shelf, right?
Yes.
Clean room environments, they care about everything. So from like a, you know, hey, let's watch what the rabbits eat so we know which mushrooms don't kill us type of methodology, it's like we can take from these industries that already have proven practices and in fact have to be adhered to per regulation. That includes not just pharmaceutical manufacturing, but even food manufacturing as well. They're worried about contaminants also, and they fight mold. And, you know, I mean, cannabis growers are fantastically smart people. They're wildly smart people, very clever, innovative. I mean, this industry's built on MacGyverisms, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so it's like, okay, well, now you're being asked, the standard is no longer bag appeal. Right? You actually have to pass a microbe test. That's the Faustian bargain that cannabis made with, you know, the legal industry is like, okay, you can operate legally out in the open, but you have to meet a minimum product safety standard.
I think that's actually good though, Jason. I mean, to be honest with you, I think that, I mean, I appreciate like the medical, there's a lot of medical markets that we call on. I'm sure that you do. And some of them, there's some testing, some of them there's not. It's very, very odd, like certain states, how sometimes the medical program doesn't do a lot of like laboratory testing, and then the adult use side will do the testing, where I feel, again, I mean, I think the verdict's out there a little bit, you know, if you're growing well and you don't have it, but I think it's just being safe. Like if I was like to have you give me tomatoes, I'm hoping that you washed them and you didn't spray like terrible chemicals on it. That's kind of how it goes. But still, when you're selling to a medical patient that might have a weakened immune system, and they're using cannabis for pain, or they're using cannabis for some kind of relief, you know, they have restless leg and they've got MS, I think that the product that they're buying from, maybe they used to buy from their local guy or their neighbor guy, or it might have been clean, but they don't really know. So I think that having clean, but I mean, I think that's a dialogue for another, you know, having a clean facility is big. But so we were chatting prior, we talked about like how we're always chasing particles in the air.
Mm-hmm.
We're chasing particles in the grow room. How do you go about, like, either, I know you said HEPA, maybe you can define HEPA a little bit, but also too, maybe we can chat a little bit about how do you go about sensing, or is it just something that it's just a preventative maintenance part of an SOP, but how do you go about like chasing particles or making sure that if someone's already up and running and you were to go into that facility and we transition it over to like your solution?
I get you. Totally. Okay. So, how about it says, okay, so Phil, let's just have a baseline acceptance of the fact that there are particles in the air. Sure. And they're low, they're smaller than the naked eye can see. So okay. For instance, if you could, if your eyes were adapted to see all of the particles in the air, you wouldn't be able to see the screen that I'm on, and nor would I be able to see you. I mean, it'd look like TV static, right?
Okay.
So that being said, how do you diagnose that there are particles in the air? And there's technology for that. So this little device over my shoulder here on the table is called a particle counter. This is a device that's common in clean rooms that will take air into an inlet in the device. It will run it past a laser. It will size it. It will count it. And it separates it out by particle sizes, right? 10 micron particles, 5 micron particles, what, all the way down to 0.3 micron. Here's the one thing. If the audience does takes one thing from this time, your smallest particle threat in cannabis is 1 micron and larger. Okay. So that's the size of like an Aspergillus fumigatus spore.
Okay.
So it's like a pill-shaped spore. So it's like 1 micron by 2 micron, you know, but call me a liar. Call me a liar for a micron, right?
No problem.
So you can detect these things through instrumentation. A particle counter is giving you a volumetric measure of the what we would call the particle burden, or what you could think of as like the soup of your air. So when it comes to the soup of your air, you would want something more like chicken broth versus like minestrone, right? Ripe with all sorts of stuff in it, right? So that's the object of the game, is to remove those particles from the space, to be able to detect them and remove them, so that if there's no particle, there's no threat.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, right. that makes sense. So you're minimizing particles in the air.
Right. Now, accepting the fact that you're not going to be able to remove all the particles, because even clean rooms have a hard time doing that, right?
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask you. You're never going to have it perfectly clean, but you want to have an acceptable amount where it's not in there.
Right. And you want to be able to track this information too. So what this particle counter can do is, yes, it can give you a volumetric measure of like, what's the particle count in a flower room versus the particle count in the hallway right outside of it. And if you have higher particle counts in your hallway, you will, you can start to understand that your hallway presents a particle threat to your flower room.
Okay.
You know, that type of stuff, and be able to map that out. Now, you're going, well, what are those particles? Fair question. So we also make another device called an air microbial sampler. This is a device you would put a petri dish into, put a sampling head over it, take in a very specific amount of air for a very specific amount of time, impact that air onto a petri dish, and then you can send it to a lab and have it analyzed. And they can culture it out. They'll grow it in an incubator, and then they have somebody called a mycologist, who's a scientist specific to identifying molds, and they'll look at it. They'll be able to figure out which species they are based on its characteristics and what the volume on that sample is. And then you can start to kind of really get a map of understanding the levels of things in the air that you might not necessarily be able to see or perceive.
That's, I was just making a note, because it's just, when you just said something, people think about probably collectively, I want to make my grow rooms cleaner. But you're right, though. It's all the ancillary rooms and all the hallways and all the other stuff. That's like the whole facility obviously has to be a clean room. But, you know, if you came from a clean train, like you just put on your clean change of clothes, you go to work and you're freshly cleaned. You don't have a grow at home. You change out of your clothes. You put on your hospital gear, your lab gear, or your suits or whatever they're putting on. But they walk down the hallway, and the hallway is full of contaminants. Now they they went from clean to contaminated, not necessarily contaminated, but less clean.
I understand.
So now a clean room or a room or a flower room that's clean, you're like, wow, you're just actually bringing stuff in there, which is kind of interesting.
Well, and there's a few things that are happening in there. Number one, the idea of gowning in something else other than what you walked in the door with is a great way to be able to help keep what's outside of the facility from coming in.
Mitigation.
So the PPE that you're wearing in the critical areas that you would call them, you're still able to spread contaminants that are already inside the building, even though you're all Tyvek'd up. Whatever's already there can still get spread around. So so the object of the game when it comes to particles and microbes is you want to figure out and prevent how they enter, how they travel around the facility, and what conditions allow it to thrive.
Yep. That makes sense. Makes perfect sense. And I think that goes down to like a lot of stuff too. Like you and I chatted prior about like GMP facilities. So facilities mm-hmm. that are being built out, you know, good manufacturing practices, good agricultural practices. So that's not really, I know over in Europe, that's super strong. And they're mm-hmm. basically, they're always talking about it. Here, right. they've talked a little bit about it, but I don't know if there's is it a governing agency, a state agency, a federal mm-hmm. agency that's going to kind of monitor how it's, I think as it goes federally legal or if it goes, mm-hmm. you know, as the industry evolves, and because it's still pretty early on, to be honest with you, it's not like it's sure. a 100-year-old industry, there'll be different governing agencies that will be able to say, hey, listen, this is yeah. the standard. You go in on one side, at your end of your work that you finish on the other, you have to walk a hallway back to get your clothes, because a lot of people are going in and out doing stuff. And I think that there's a lot of, not saying that they're dirty facilities.
No. But there's, you know, people don't know what they don't know. Of course. Right. So like, I'll give you a great example is, you know, like the boxes of gloves that are all over a facility. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are exam gloves that are often purchased. And it's like, I'm trying to help change the thinking of how cultivators approach their product, because to provide some context, you know, agriculture practices are great for agriculture, but what are you growing? You're growing an apple that has a natural skin. You're growing a cucumber that has a natural skin. You're growing a tomato that has a natural skin. Everything that's in the background behind you is like growing flypaper that gets you high. I mean, all yeah. the moneymaker is on the outside of that plant, right?
It's attracting everything.
Right. So those airborne particles that are moving about the facility are in some cases depositing directly on your plants. And you can see that, like if you get a crop that has bud rot in it or something like that. And there are certain species of mold that will attack living plants. And then there are certain species of mold that are more like recyclers, like Aspergillus niger, for example, is more of a recycler where it returns dead animals and plants into the food soil web to be used in the future, right? So Aspergillus niger, for example, usually won't go to work on the plant until it senses that it's necrotic material, and thus it senses it's dead material. So that's where, you know, it's not that like your dry room has a problem. It's that the problem probably happened in veg or flower, and you've been carrying it through, but it didn't activate until chop.
Until it cut down. Well, that's the thing too, is like a lot of labs are testing, because I feel that there's good spores and bad spores, like in anything. Mm-hmm. And like when the laboratories test, they're testing for any. So,
So it depends on the state regulations, right? Sure. To go back to the earlier part of your question, a lot of states have different sets of regulations. Some of them are four types of species, detect, non-detect. Others are just a general total yeast and mold count. Both have their pluses and their minuses, right? So if you're only needing to be compliant to four types of mold, well, technically, I mean, you don't want anything in there you don't want, but it will be passable, right?
Okay.
However, if you're into a state that has a total yeast and mold count, that total yeast and mold count will catch and count anything that is caught on the sample.
All right.
Unfortunately, that can sometimes be like beneficial bacteria and microbes as well, unfortunately, yeah. right? So it's this double-edged sword where, I mean, on one hand, listen, you know, you've been selling this to the government as medicine, and now they're trying to tell you, okay, it's medicine. Great. You got to make medicine the way medicine's made, right? Whoa, wait. What are you talking about, yeah, right?
Exactly.
But then on the other hand, it's like the states aren't fully in touch with the nuances of cannabis. They're still treating it like an agriculture crop or they're, you know, stuff like that. So there are, it varies state by state, unfortunately, until there's a federal regulation in place. Yeah. But some states are actually starting to not just tell you, okay, the product at the end of the cycle has to test negative for all this stuff. Now they're starting to like work in, this is how you have to operate on a daily basis to get to that point. Yep. And that's what food and pharma has to answer mm-hmm. to. So it's not just that your, you know, Viagra at the end has to test cool for like zero microbes. It's like there's aseptic processes from the time that the powdered ingredients for a Viagra tablet enter the warehouse to the time that it goes and is released to the production line, and how the production line, very meticulous, not impossible or insurmountable to learn though. That's the cool part.
That is cool. I mean, getting back on track, like, so filter, you are a company that has filters that go for grow rooms and mm-hmm. different parts of the facility. Why is the air movement and filtration so important? I know it's kind of like going back to all the things that we are talking about, but sure. like, what, why is that super important?
Well, because number one, most of the problems that start in your, or that are in your facility have started in the air.
Okay.
Okay, so that's one thing that's going on. Number two, the buildings that are often built, cannabis construction, especially those that are running CO2, federal fire codes mandate that you have to be negatively pressured.
Okay.
You know, so you, in other words, you can't be blasting CO2 out into the hallway and, you know.
Got to stay in the room.
Right, it's got to stay in the room. But because of that level of negative pressure, it is pulling air in from the envelope of the building in. So there's all sorts of stuff that's swirling around the outside of the building, cladosporiums and mold spores and blah, 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 blah. Just right?
Natural stuff that's outside. Like, I mean, and we're coming up on spring here. I'm in New England.
Yeah.
I mean, coming up on spring. I mean, there's going to be pollen season. There's going to be all sorts of crap in the air. Everybody's
absolutely
getting stuffy head. I mean, there's just stuff in the air.
Right. I mean, and so every building has what you would call a leak rate. There's a leak. Either it leaks in or it leaks out. Right. And so this happens in home construction as well all the time. So, like, let's say at your house, you have a lighting fixture on the outside of your front porch, right? Like a little like front porch yeah. light. The area behind there, if your house is negatively pressured, those micro cracks and fissures can pull things in to the interior of the wall, find their way out the electrical outlet, and now it's inside your house. Meanwhile, it's hitting all of the wood that's on the interior of your walls, right? So it's, and mold loves wood, right? So, you know, it allows problems to sometimes proliferate inside your walls, which then make their way into the rooms. Mm-hmm. That happens. It's very common. So you have exterior air threats. You have the fact that your building is pulling those types of threats in, but then you also have people as well. People are constantly shedding particles. You right now, Tony, are sitting there shedding 100,000 particles per minute, just standing still. If you go like this, 5 million particles right here. No, but you know, a lot of it is skin, admittedly, but your skin has its own natural microbiome to it, as well as it will attract just things from the air, from your house, from your car. Heaven forbid you go to the hydro store. Don't ever go to the hydro store and then go to work. Go home, yeah, change.
Terrible. There's so many people in there with all right. sorts of stuff.
So we're constantly shedding particles into the air. So humans are contributors to it as much as environment.
Okay. That's pretty cool. I mean, that's I mean, you can see that. Like, we call it like a cross-contamination type thing. I mean, there are people mm-hmm. coming in. And I'm very aware of that too, because I call in a lot of facilities similar to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I make sure that I haven't, like, my clothes are clean before I go there. And then I bring in my car, I travel with Tyvek suits. And I have the hoodie ones, I have the boots. It's a full one thing. I'm not even leaving preparation for my socks.
I bring one with me all the time. I have both a lab coat and a Tyvek suit. I get it.
Yeah, it's easy. It's just one of those. I want to have it with me. I don't want to be the cause of someone's issues.
Agreed.
What types of mitigation do we have available? So, like, okay, so we're talking about molds. We're talking about the importance of air, you know, air pressures and like stuff getting in from the outside. What types of, like, I'll call it, you know, air mitigation is there available for people to get?
Sure. Well, so we have devices like ours, like third-party devices that work well with your native HVAC systems. So you have HEPA filtration. It's also important, just to go back to HVAC for a second, it's important to make sure that you're using an optimum filter level, you know, a level of filtration in your HVAC system. So HVAC filtration has like various ratings to it. It's called the MERV rating system, minimum efficiency reporting value.
Okay.
And that won't be on the test. Don't worry. So different MERV ratings correlate to like a performance standard. So, you know, MERV 13 removes 90% or better of 1 micron and larger. MERV 11 only removes 85% of 1 micron and larger.
Okay.
So, to be able to optimize your air filtration in the building mechanicals is huge, but that tops out at a certain point. So if you jam a filter that's too thick of a media for your mechanicals, you're going to stress your air conditioner units, you're going to lose cooling capacity, what have you. So that's where filter kind of answers that call to say, listen, you don't have to rip out and replace a perfectly good climate control system just for the sake of the air filtration. Why don't you just bring something in that just attacks the problem, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, in cannabis, there's a lot of technology that is being applied from other industries that is not like a one-to-one equivalent.
Cannabis is and different.
So for instance, like, so I'm HEPA, right? I'm the equivalent of if you had a cloud of baseballs flying at you from center field to home plate, you'd be perfectly safe to just go walk behind the backstop.
Okay.
Right? Versus other types of devices that you would call kill technology, which is like the equivalent of trying to knock a cloud of baseballs out of the air with another cloud of baseballs.
All right.
You know, you're going to have some entropy. You're going to, some stuff's going to get through. It's not one to one. So, you know, for instance, we see UV in hospitals all the time, right? Yeah, UV is common. But here's the thing you need to know about UV as you would apply it to cannabis is that your mold spores have a chitin shell around them versus bacteria and virus that they're concerned about in hospitals, which have a protein or a lipid layer. So UV light reacts to them or causes a reaction a lot quicker. So your exposure time for mold spores is a lot longer compared to your exposure time for bacteria and virus. So think about all these people that are like, yeah, I put UV in my HVAC system, so all the air that's passing into the rooms is running by a UV light. But it's going too fast to be able to meet that contact time, that exposure time. Yeah. So, I mean, and not only that, but UV is like, you know, if you're putting it on a surface, how high of a from the surface do you have to be? The inverse law of light still applies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I actually just posted on Instagram about a study that a guy did where he put a UV light, like I think it was like 7.5 feet. He put it up on his ceiling, and then he put a petri dish at 2 feet, 2.5 feet, 5 feet, 7 feet, and held it there for X amount of time. And he like grew out the petri dishes, and you can clearly see the one that was right under the light, clean as a whistle, fantastic. But the one that was the lowest one looked just like the control sample.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, right. Because I was curious about that when you said that. Like, I know that people have talked about UV in their HVAC system, but you're right. That's a great point. That if the air's moving too fast, it doesn't have time to do its work.
Right. I mean, just some basic math. Right. They established that COVID, for example, took 30 seconds of exposure of UV in order to eradicate it. Right. Cool.
Okay.
So that means if you wanted to target
what did that do to us, or is that the type of UV that is harmful to people?
UVC, yeah, is harmful to people. That's what's filtered out by the ozone layer, right? Okay. But let's say, for example, you wanted to kill COVID in your HVAC system. That would mean you would have to have UV light. You'd have to do the calculation, right? What's your CFM of your air conditioning system, right? How fast is the airflow? And then you have to calculate that by how much ducting you have. So to maintain 30 seconds of exposure time, you'd need like 500 feet of UV light in order to achieve that eradication. Crazy, right? And you know, then there's also like photocatalytic oxidation. You see those in like I don't want to name any names, but it rhymes with Schmero Clean 420. Sure. You know, they're a different type of process. And if I want to keep my tomatoes from ripening on the way from the farm to the market, I'm calling them all day. I'm not going to be able to do that job. But what I can tell you is the amount of reaction time that it takes for an eradication to take place means they have to slow down the airflow in order to increase that exposure time. And with that, you lose overall room air exchange. That's what you said.
Yeah, because it's all about exchanging the air in the room. Now, is there any, I know you were saying like different thicknesses of filters. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's going to affect like the airflow, and you don't want to stress the HVAC. There's already enough stress on it trying to cool this place. That's just an oven with lighting.
Right, right.
It's like an easy bake oven.
Yeah.
There's different airflow. Like, so the filters that you guys represent, there's no airflow. I mean, it's minimal. It's the minimal that you can get for airflow restrictions. It's already adjusted for the airflow.
Well, yeah. So HEPA comes in like what you would call H13 and H14. Those are the two HEPA ratings, right? And you have to strike a balance between the particles you're trying to target, 1 micron and larger,
okay,
and being able to get optimum airflow. So H13 and H14 will both capture 1 micron particles, but you'll get less restrictive airflow out of an H13. So that's what we settled on. And so HEPA, as it stands, is actually a standard of measure. So the standard of measure is basically for every 10,000 particles that go through, only 3 are allowed to come out the back end.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
That's actually quite interesting.
Yeah. There's a specific standard for meeting HEPA.
Wow, that's just, it's just, now how does, like, when someone, like, because the particles are so small, I'm sure there's a lot of dust particles in there. So the filter's just kind of the, like, lifespan of, like, some of these things that we're putting in. Now, is it going, the solution that you have, does it go in the HVAC or is it a standalone unit?
It's going to be a standalone unit. You do have the option of, like, mounting it from a ceiling or putting it on a wall or putting it on post support or something like that. So it does have, but it is an in-room device that operates completely independent of the HVAC system. And it's
so just, it works with their HVAC and all their fans. And so there's air moving around the room, because that's always big within cannabis, that they need good air movement. The plants need to kind of do a small, easy shake. Yeah. So this goes into the room in a corner along a wall, or there's multiple of these units within, depending on the grow size, grow room size.
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, we would do like 3.5 air exchanges per hour within 10,000 cubic feet.
Oh, it talks about how many times. Okay. Right on. So how many times you can cycle through all the air in the room to go through the filter?
Right. So that's like roughly, if you calculate it out, it's about every 17 minutes we're refreshing that air within that space.
Interesting.
But if you have a 5,000 cubic foot room, then you're getting 7 air exchanges per hour. So it's a sliding scale around, like, how I calculate out, like, how, what the size of the room is, divide by 10,000. That's how many filter units I would recommend in order to maintain that 3.5 air exchange per hour.
And what are they run all day, every day? There's no, they never
24/7. Yeah.
The filters that are in there, are they replaceable? Are they cleanable?
Well, they're replaceable. So it's effectively like a drum style of filter with like a bunch of pleated media in between the cage, if you will. And that's to increase the amount of surface area where particles can be captured, right? I mean, the difference between like a flat filter versus a pleated filter. So inside the filter media, that there's 98.5 square feet of HEPA material inside of our filter.
Okay.
So typically for like my cannabis clients, I would recommend changing that filter every 9 months to a year in a flower environment, probably every 6 to 9 months in a dry environment, and every 6 months or so in a trim environment, just due to the increasing levels of particulate load in those rooms.
Of what's there. Now, what do you see people putting them? Is that something you think there's a demand for it or a call for it in common areas, hallways, break rooms?
Absolutely. I do particle counts in facilities all the time. And I have to show people, I'm like, clearly you put the money into the flower room because your HVAC is rocking like docking, right? But then you go to the hallway or the gowning area or the entryway area, and that's just your run-of-the-mill HVAC system. You know, there's nothing fancy schmancy about it. It's more designed for like climate control rather than particle removal. So do I suggest these in the hallway? Yeah, absolutely. Frankly, I mean, if you think about it, your hallway it's a main artery for your building that touches a lot of different places and processes in the building. So the cross-contamination potential is huge. I mean, think about moving veg plants to flower on a flip day, or think about moving, you know, chopped plants into dry areas. You know, they both crisscross the same hallway for the most part.
In the hallway too, like if you think about, okay, so they cut down all the plants, it just say it takes them a day or two. Mm-hmm. So they cut down plant one and they didn't throw that root ball away with that stem or stalks in there, that's just rotting. So that's just developing stuff. So I mean, like, I bet you there's a ton of on waste plants. There's probably a ton of, that's just a great opportunity for stuff to grow. Mm-hmm.
I have to talk to facilities all the time about how they handle their biomass, like refuse management.
Sure.
You know, I mean, because it's, I've seen it firsthand, you know, like I do consultancy as well. So like I'll watch processes and just observe for a day. And, you know, you can see somebody like bag up all the trash and then they run it through the hallway, they drop it in the trash area, and then they go right back to work in another flower area. And it's like, you know, so one thing that is like, I find absolutely crucial around managing microbes within the facility is how you schedule your tasks and your labor and your foot traffic. If there's people who don't have to be in there, don't let them in there. I mean, I was just in a facility where I was taking a look at a filter unit and, you know, like they wanted to evaluate if it needed a filter change. So I was doing a particle test on it. And I told them, I said, listen, if I don't need to go into the critical area, don't let me in. You know, like visitors that go in are an insane variable, because like, think about it this way. You have auditors and law enforcement who don't care about your microbe control, you know, and not only that, but they're not obliged to adhere to it either legally.
And right? Also, and if you think about it, you're trying to say, hey, listen, we're trying to keep our microbial counts down. They really don't care. They just don't care. They're like, listen, they think everyone's hot because it came from such an elusive gray market in a shadow market. Everybody thinks you're always trying to hide something on them. And possibly you are. I mean, whatever. I'm
sure it's not like it's never happened, right?
Exactly. But I mean, it's so like the enforcement agencies are probably like, we have to see everything. That's why there's so much cameras too. I mean,
Absolutely. Well, okay. So it's not just auditors, inspectors, law enforcement, fire department, building code, those kind of guys that are just doing their job. Then you have the investors that want to bring their buddies by to like show off the grow, right? Oh, yeah. You don't know where they've been. You don't know who they are. You don't know where they come from. Then you have, let's say you have like people that are doing like a photo shoot, you know, you bring in some cannabis model that's like going to like touch your plants with their hands as she's doing her pose, you know, where she's smelling the bud. And
so we have you and I, because we're a good pretty face.
Yeah, I know, right? I'm telling you, 10,000 microbes per square inch on this hand, right? I mean, and if you think that's ugly, have you seen this? But so you know, like, but where's all that camera equipment been? You know, who are those people? Where do they come from? And then, you know, then there's the employees themselves, right? Like, how many of your employees are growing at home and bringing their home drama into the office?
That's what I see. That's what I think. There's a lot of discrepancy in people, and I don't think that there's enough. Not saying you got to scan everybody or everybody goes through like a blow chamber or clean chamber or a chamber that sprays air as well as bleach or what, I don't know what it is.
Yeah, right. I mean,
there's definitely got to be something, because there's so many growers or guys that work in the cultivation that I meet, or gals, doesn't matter.
People.
They have tents and they're growing this stuff and they're like, I grow clean. Do you? Because I mean, without me scanning you, like I don't know if you do grow clean. Are you cleaning? Are you wearing the same hat? I went into a couple facilities that they won't let you wear an outside hat into their facility because the hats, you don't wash your hat like every day, like you wash your clothes.
Smart move. I endorse that.
If I went in with a hat, they'd ask me to take it off and put on a hairnet or they'll give me a new hat. They have like boxes of hats. Those pretty impressive.
And did they ask you to wear a beard guard?
They did, yeah. They good. Do beard guard. Yeah, they're really good. I feel like I've got like the full mask on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, I'd rather do that than contaminate somebody's space. I'm very 100%. Clear with my clients. I only do one facility visit a day if I have to. You know,
I only do one a day. Like if I'm going to a facility, and I'm not going into the grow rooms or going into
crucial
areas. If I'm just meeting somebody, like
Lunch or whatever, right? Yeah,
exactly. And, I went there. Somebody needed something. I had to drop something off. That was fine. No, it actually was funny. I was in the Midwest and I was at a grow and it's under construction, but I don't know if it's the municipality or the state. They were saying because there was kind of some corruption as the processes went through and there was a lot of litigation and kind of crap that went on in that state. They're making people, might just be the county, but they're making people hold their crop waste for 7 days. Like they wanted to store it. And he's like, what do you mean store it? So they have to design an area of a facility to hold all the crap.
That's so weird.
Mind-boggling to me. I don't know. It boggles my mind because that is such a, there's just so much garbage and like you don't, and like who has that kind of space and like what are you waiting for? It's like, because the process, like you harvest it and then you got to dry it. Now you got to cure it. Now you get sent out for testing. They were saying like they really just said, well, you got to hold it for 1 week. That doesn't really matter or mean anything. Like, I don't want to hold it for at all. Like, I want to put that in a compactor or in a locked bin outside because there is some trace THC in the root ball and all that. I mean, it's not really.
I mean,
sit down, but it's not.
I mean, listen, if that's what you're going for to extract THC out of it, I think you got bigger problems.
Well, you know? I'm just saying, like, the cleanliness. I'm like, are you in a facility where, like, just think about all the dirt and all just the crap. Because as soon as you toss that soil, even if it's a cocoa or if it's a growing media, there's stuff that's just living in there that where if you just let it be, it's fine. But as soon as you go to move and shake it around, like you said, if you shake your hand around, it goes up by 10 or 20 times.
Oh, completely. I mean, and I have to coach a lot of facilities around, like, you know, those that are using carbon-based medias, right? Your cocos, your peats, your soils, right? Like, every time you scoop it from the bag into the pot, right? Like, the dirt you see that's falling in is nothing compared to exactly what's pluming up into the facility. Yeah. And so, I get that, like, growers are often married to their methodologies, right? I came up in soil. I'm sticking with soil. Cool. Okay. But you have to realize that your material handling practices are leaving dusts and dirts and microbes, allowing them to proliferate as you're carrying stuff through your hallway, as you're moving it into your room, as you're taking it out at the end of the cycle. So material handling practices are like super keen if you're going to be working with something that's granulated and carbon based versus a rock wall or something like that. You know,
100%. I have a grow, and the guy's amazing. Like, they actually do. They have like living soil beds where they're crop rotating. But his deal is he keeps like these. Like, he has like two guys that work in the like each room. He say he's got eight rooms. Mm-hmm. And, like, he very rarely shifts the guys unless it's needed. So, like, mm-hmm. they're pretty good sized rooms. So he keeps the same guys in the room. If they have a tool that falls in the growing media, you go get a new tool that stays there until the end of the cycle. They don't even pick it up. They have like a cover crop. So he's like, he's got super strict rules about if you're defoaling or you're doing something and you drop a tool, it's there. You don't move it. Like, don't dig it out of there, because that tool is in the bottom of that, and you're going to dig through the dirt and all the leaves that are down there below. That's like any of that cover crop. He's like, and he's actually passing all of his testings.
That's fantastic.
Because he's just like, listen, these are just some rules. He goes, things that are just good practices to have. That's not saying it work for everyone, but I think it's smart.
Well, and that you're right. I mean, there is as many ways to grow as there are growers, right?
Yeah.
However, when it comes to like controlling molds and microbes, it gets a lot more narrow as far as like specific practices that are effective. So, you know, speaking of tools, for example, I always recommend, that every room has their own set of tools, and that do not leave the room, that even if you can go the extra step, color code them or identify them in some way, so that if you're in a red tool room and you see a blue tag tool, you know, to get that out of there and that it shouldn't have been in there in the first place.
That's a great idea.
They make the tool in color. I mean, in various colors. You can buy like 25 different colors of brooms. They exist.
Just leave them there.
Yeah, and you just leave them there, and a white tool doesn't go in the pink tool room, and vice versa. You know, so because tool cross contamination is pretty rife. I mean, and then there's the common tool areas that are they disinfected before and after their use? You know. Yeah. And you want to go one more. This is like kind of the Jedi level knowledge. Then there's something called dirty hold time or clean hold time. Okay. So the question becomes, so let's say you wash something, you put it up on a shelf. How long after you've cleaned that and shelved it, is it still considered clean before the environment has enacted on it in order to like contaminate it again? But cannabis is just willy-nilly going, oh, I cleaned it 3 weeks ago. It's fine. I'm going to grab it and take it into the room.
That you're 100% right on that, because that's like what when they do, like, you have the spray counter spray,
mm-hmm. right?
And you sanitize the area. So the top level of the surface is, I mean, if you were to test it right after you sprayed it,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty much disease, bacteria free, whatever,
right?
Because it's all at the surface level. But you could spray that over something that's dirty, that's still dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so they like you're right. And then, like, I always see this too, like, you go into places and there's just dust and they just cannabis growing. There's just, it kicks up. There's so much air movement, mm-hmm. and so much soil and leaves, and I'll call it just pollen from the plant. There's stuff in the air. Like there's just dust everywhere.
Yeah, you're in what's called a turbulent airflow environment, right?
Yep, for sure.
So in clean rooms, for example, the way they design clean rooms is all of their fan filter units, as they would call them. Like, imagine these HEPA filters, but they're like the size of a ceiling panel. you know, like a drop ceiling panel. They line the entire ceiling with them, and all of the air comes down at the same rate at the same time. And then it goes into intakes at the bottom, goes up a dead wall space, and then goes back into their fan filter units. And so they're trying to recycle and re-clean as much of their own air as possible. Cannabis, just modern cannabis facility design has not accounted for that yet. And, you know,
it's going to be there at some point. And I think there's expensive. A lot of good designers. We work with a lot of different architects, and I think it's, I just think that there's some really, really good technology out there that I think it'll catch up. But I mean, there's going to be some people that if they're not designing, I've had people on the podcast and we've talked a lot about good, you know, proper designing of a facility and designing it for proper airflow and proper workflow. And like, what is your, like we said before, like, what is your GM? What is your good manufacturing practice? Like, there's a lot of things, a lot of steps you can take today that could not necessarily future proof you, but at least set you up for some success down the line.
I agree. And so that's where, like, I mean, it is amazing, like, the correlation and the similarities that clean room environments have with cannabis environments with regards to mold and microbe control. You know, I think, as I stated before, it's like, you know, cannabis gets to kind of pick and choose what they want, what they don't want. And that's what they're trying to fight. Whereas clean rooms are going for anything and everything to get it out of the room. So to understand that higher level standard, I mean, there's a ton of best practices that one could apply that don't necessarily require money. You know what I mean? Like understanding, you know, the difference between clean and disinfected. Because those two terms are correlated, they're used a lot, they're conflated a lot. And so what I typically have to recommend to my clients is you do need to do a surface cleaning first with a detergent in order to get the dirt and muck off, because that's what exposes the microbes underneath.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, it's sometimes to growers, it sounds like I'm telling them they have to clean twice, and I'm not. What I'm saying is, put all the time and the effort and the mechanical cleaning action into getting the surface dirt off, and then go through in foam or fog or something that's a little bit easier from an effort standpoint. Just make sure you get complete coverage. Your disinfectants are meeting its contact time. You're not using anything that's expired.
Yeah.
You got to make sure that it's right. Or that it's compatible with all of your surfaces. I mean, would you hate to like put a chemical to like clean your tables, your rolling benches, and then all of a sudden there's a hole in your rolling bench because the chemical dissolved
something? Are there certain calm disinfectants or cleaners that people can use? Is everything basically the same across each state, or each state has a little bit different set of rules?
There's not a lot of like specific state regulations around disinfectants as much as like you would think there, like the way that there is with pesticides, for example.
Oh yeah.
Because a lot of times, like even in pharma and other critical manufacturing places, those chemical disinfectants oftentimes will specify if you need to do like a clear water rinse afterwards because it leaves a residue.
Sure.
So you want to know, like, so your contaminants in a grow facility are going to fall mostly under three categories. They're going to fall under chemical contaminants, like cleaners that get into your process, physical contaminants, like metal shavings off of a joint rolling machine that fall into the joint, you know, that type of thing. And then there's microbial, which is like molds and bacteria and what have you.
Okay.
So from that standpoint, you know, contamination, while I happen to specialize on the mold and microbe side of things, you know, it helps to have a more holistic view. But to go back to your, you know, state, there's not a lot of, as far as I know, there's nothing from a state regulation standpoint that says that you can't use certain disinfectants. But the question becomes, do you want to use that disinfectant?
Yes.
Because it might have some residual effects down the line. Certain chemicals, for example, eat away at circuitry of machinery if you don't use it properly.
We know that.
Yeah. I mean, how many times has somebody been spraying some sort of chemical around the, and then they're like, my lights aren't working. What happened? And then they send it back and you're like, oh, it's all white and corroded. Because something got in
there. Coming down. There's people out there that are spraying, they're spraying some harsh chemicals and you can see it's rusting up stuff. And you're like, if it's rusting out your racking and your shelving, it's rusting out everything else. Like it's super toxic. But if you were to in a nutshell, I know we can chat for hours because I love
big nut, right? Go ahead.
But if you could give like a recap of what is a good, you know, Filter as a company and what you do when you go out and you scan them and you tell them what their microbial count, this is what you recommend. But like, could you give like kind of nice recap of what you guys do and how people can get a hold of you? I think this is just great. I just love having
you
about this.
Absolutely. So Filter by Lighthouse Worldwide Solutions, we are designed to remove airborne particles, but we also make the type of equipment that can help test and detect microbes within your facility. So with that, you know, I'm always happy to answer questions because I believe in full service and there's more to this problem, solving this problem than just tossing in a magic box. It's bigger than that, right? Everybody wants a magic box. Ain't going to happen. There's no silver bullet. So to know everything about that facility and its cleanliness and standards and practices is essential. And so I really try to be a more full spectrum type of source of help and knowledge. So with that, I do post regularly on Instagram under Dyslexic Stoner 402. Okay. For those of you that are on the gram, and it's daily microbe control tips. And, you know, I mean, I'm rarely posting about Filter and, you know, particle counters and air samplers, because again, there's so many other things you haven't thought of, right? Like, how do you get to a root cause analysis? How do you get to a root cause? You have a problem. You don't know where it's coming from. What are the questions and what are the methodologies one would use to deduce that problem? You know,
do you feel that's important to be in part of like the design plan of the project, or do you, I mean, I bet you're getting called.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's like, I mean, it's a loaded question. I know the answer.
Yeah.
I mean, but I think it's important for them to have you guys in there before they even bring plants or bring media, bring stuff in the room, cleaning this air, because people are saying, I didn't pass testing. What am I going to do about it? So they chose to, I don't want to say cheapen out, but maybe they just didn't have the funding to do it yet. Mm-hmm. So they had a couple of harvests that came down that were kind of shitty.
Yeah.
It is. Now they're going to put it in these systems now to help mitigate it. But the problem is there. Like if they started from the beginning without it.
Agreed. And so, yes, I mean, you're right. I should be at the design phase. And in some cases I am. But the why of it is important because, you know, in some cases, like, you know, it might be suggesting like, hey, maybe you don't want to put a bathroom right in your critical area. Maybe you want your employees to go out to use the bathroom and then regown to go back in, you know, same thing with break rooms, like people congregating in a break room. Like, think about it. You got three people that were in flower two, four people that were in flower five, some people that were in drying, and then everybody takes their lunch at 12:30. And they're all co-mingling in the break room, still in their
PPE. They all have their gowns on. They just go right back into their.
And then they go right back to their next task. You know, it happens all the time. And so, but again, that just has it. So that the flow through of how employees operate, I have some insights on from a pharmaceutical background perspective. And then also building material choices as well. So I'll just leave you with this, that like there's something called USP 797, which is the standards for building and designing. I'll send you an email on this. Is the standard for building and designing pharmaceutical compounding facilities, sterile compounding facilities.
Okay.
One of the things they state is that all of your materials should be non-porous, non-shedding, and synthetic.
Okay.
So think about the next time you walk into a facility that has like particle board drop ceiling tiles in their hallway.
They just like sprayed an old mill building and thinking it's going to be good.
Yeah, right. And whatever falls from the roof onto the tile is a mold risk. You know, whatever is in the hallway that it adheres to an organic surface. Because remember, you know, those acoustic sound tiles, they're made from trees effectively. Yeah. Ground up trees, right?
I mean, we could talk for hours about this stuff. Thinking about doing a clean, like a build out of like a new facility, like ground up, you know, it's green space. They're putting up and standing up a new building. But a lot of times they put these facilities, they're like, hey, there's a bunch of old mills. Why don't you build them in there? And you're like, again.
Yeah. The history of the building is super important. And I even tell people, baseline your building. So there's two things that can happen. Number one, let's say you're planning to purchase a building. You're looking at a building, you know, that you're not building yourself, right? Yeah. I would tell my client, the prospect, saying, hey, you, before you make any decisions, take a bunch of air samples, take a bunch of swab samples, and then get those evaluated, because if there's a problem in there already, what are you going to build and operate on top of it without knowing that, without remediating it out? Number two, if that is an issue and you still want to move forward with the building, well, now you get a little bit of juice on the price. You know, you have some negotiating power, you know. And then after construction, right when the last nail and screw goes in, before plants are moved in, I would take another round of samples there, because if there's something in that building, you have an opportunity to catch it before you start operating on top of it. And thirdly, is that now that you've done that before plants moved in, you know what the building was like. So now you have cleanliness targets to aspire to.
That's awesome. I like that idea. I like that idea. Well, man, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about just air quality, air movement, things, how important it is.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, I just like, I mean, every day I am in the industry, I mean, I learn stuff. It's just great. Yeah,
I know. But, lifelong student. You become a lifelong student.
And really, especially in this industry, because stuff is changing, it's evolving, and they're, mm-hmm. like you say, they're moving, they're transitioning from different industry to this industry, and how they're adapting, and it's just wild. And then as different states come online and different countries come online, you know, it's just all different rules and regulations. It's really exciting times to be in this business and in this industry. But Jason, thank you so much. Jason from my good friend Jason from Filter, and thank you for coming on the show. It's been great dialogue.
I'm incredibly grateful. I've been wanting to do this with you for a long time. So absolutely. I really appreciate
thank you so much. That's fun. This is fun absolutely. Stuff. But great. Thanks, man. Mm-hmm.